So I'm going to read Judges 2 for us today, which is an amazing and complete summary of the end of Joshua's responsibilities for the people of Israel. And it just perfectly summarizes everything that we see in Judges. And so I'm actually not going to preach Judges 2 because it's so concise and clear. We just have to read it to understand. So if you pay attention through the reading, if you paid attention through your reading when you read it the first time, but again, as you hear it, you'll just see the perfect summarization. Every once in a while we get these, usually at the beginning or end of a book, just a beautiful transitional synopsis. And this one doesn't just bridge the gap between Joshua and Judges, but it sets us up for everything that must come after. So let me just read it, and then I'll actually preach around and through Judges 2. So here it is, all of Judges 2. Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? And he's talking about the failure of the conquest of the land. So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, something he had promised to do over and over. But they shall become thorns in your sides. And actually, when Moses says that at the end of Deuteronomy, he says, they'll become thorns in your eyes. It'll literally like blind you on your travels and in your functioning. You'll be blind. And their God shall be a snare to you. As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim. And they sacrificed there to the Lord. Bochim meaning weepers. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua. They did serve the Lord all the days of Joshua, relatively successfully. And all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. And they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them. I think these are probably the millennials. After them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of the surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges. He uses pretty extreme language here. For they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning, because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods. When I first read through Judges, the immediate text of a sermon that came to my mind was religious laundry, because their cycle of religion is so repetitive. But when I read this verse, it's not just history repeating itself over and over. It's the people of Israel degrading further and further down the toilet. It's like you keep on washing that laundry, and the clothing might get clean, but the clothing degrades, and the fibers tear, and it weakens. And this is the picture of Israel. Worse than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them, and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And he said, because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died. In order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not. The choice is theirs. He's really driving choice here, as Joshua did at the end of his message to the people. Whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not. And every generation has that choice, and every individual has that choice. So it concludes with that sad note. So the Lord left those nations, not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into the hand of Joshua. So that's a pretty whole synopsis. There's not a lot to add to that, even though the connections are endless. If we look at the language connections in the Torah that we got through. But there's another way that I'd like to work through this material and this period of Israel's history. And that's to look through the eyes. If you ever want a kind of a quick way to look through a book and kind of its trends and its movements, do a word study. You can do a simple word study online of the word eyes. And it's a little harder in English, because if you use eyes, you might not pick up sight, which the verses I'm going to give you, they're either translated as eyes or sight when you see them. But if you ever want a really easy way to follow kind of the flow of the narrative of the Old Testament, do a word study on the eyes, because that's where you get the perception of the people, the perception of God looking at the people or down on the people. And it's kind of an easy shortcut way to see the flow of things. And so that's what I want to do today. I want to look through just a few parts of Joshua, and then just do a word study with you of the eyes or the sight through Judges. And you can just see the flow of things. And I think it'll become very clear. You won't just see people having, you know, metaphorically sight of God and then becoming blind to him, but you see actually a degradation of the sight, like we experience over age. It slowly degrades. It's not just back and forth. And so I'd like to do that with you. It's a little different style today, but I just want to go through. It's going to be a bit of an extensive list here, but I'm just going to follow this word study of the people's eyes and also God's eyes. And you'll see that contrast between what the people see and therefore do, and how they make their judgments, their perception, and how God sees the situation. And so, just quickly, you can decide to turn to these or not. Some of them I'm going to spend very short time on. I have to spend short time on all of them, or I'll get fired. No, But in an ideal world where you had, you know, a better presenter, you would see it on the screen. You know, I have the first, that might make it easier. I didn't get through all of them because there were so many. But if the HDMI cord is here, I know it's not good to do this while we're live. But if the cord's here, sister, because you've mentioned it, and it will help. If this works, it'll work. And if it doesn't, it won't. It's a great idea. This doesn't count for my time, by the way. So whoever's... This is Barbara. This isn't me. I would never do this. Okay. Yep. Joe, if you help me with that, and I'll go through as best I can. Okay, so we're going to look at Judges through the eyes, okay? Beautiful. Okay, so the first occurrence we're going to look at of the eyes or the sight is in Joshua 9. This is a very cool, a very clear use of the sight as perception and making a judgment. And so the people here of Gibeon are supposed to be destroyed, but they come craftily to Joshua, right? They pretend they're someone they're not, and they make a covenant with them, which we just read. You're not supposed to covenant with these people. You're supposed to keep the covenant with God, not covenant with others. Of course, that doesn't happen because Israel sees fit to make their own judgment apart from God here, and they don't ask God to weigh in because they're the people of God, and they can figure it out. And the end of that passage concludes with Israel being upset about the deception. And the people of Israel wanted to wipe these people out, but Joshua recognizing it's more important to keep to our word here. And we've made a commitment, however wrong, we've made a covenant with these people. And so the people respond with the use of this word, ayin, that lies behind all these words I'll show you today. Whether it shows up as eyes or sight, the Hebrew is ayin. It can mean eye. It can also mean a spring of water or a fountain. Okay? I think there's probably a lot of meaning packed into that. But anyways, the eyes are kind of the lens of our perception. So the people of Gibeon put it to Israel to say, okay, whatever seems good and right in your sight, you do that to us. Okay? So that's the first occurrence I wanted to point out. The next one here is when you get up to the nearing the end of the conquest, okay? Joshua has conquered all the land that he's going to conquer, essentially. But something strange happens. If you remember, most of the people are to the, my east and west are bad, or eat shredded wheat. Most of the people are to the west of the Jordan, okay? But the 2.5 clans asked to be east of the Jordan. My wife does all the directions. So they're on the east of the Jordan. At the end of the conquest, they build an altar, which is concerning when there's been so many warnings about false worship. And so the people come up with a zealous and a righteous concern. All the people of Israel come up, and they're ready to have a civil war, the east and the west sides of the Jordan. And the people of Reuben and the other tribes there, they say, look, we're not here to offer sacrifices. We built the altar so that our kids will remember what happened. And so they remember who we worship. But we're not going to offer inappropriate worship here. And so you get this use of the eyes, of this judgment, of the people's making a judgment here. And the report was good in the eyes of the people of Israel. The people of Israel blessed God and spoke no more of making war against them to destroy the land where the people of Reuben and the people of Gad were settled. Now you get to Joshua's powerful statements, his message, like the one given by Moses at the end of his life in Deuteronomy 31 to 34. Here, it's in Joshua 23 and 24, his last message. And he's really trying to stir the people to follow the Lord. But it's interesting, he uses the eyes as the description of the people making an appropriate judgment. And so he says, warning them against idolatry, warning them against clinging to the remnant in the land that they didn't destroy, right? He knows that's going to be a persistent problem, so he's warning them, don't make connections with these people. You were supposed to wipe them out. And do not worship their gods. And he reminds them, know for certain, the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you, but they shall be a snare and a trap for you, a whip on your sides, and here it is, it wasn't Deuteronomy, it was Joshua, a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes. Again, it's like these nations and their gods will blind you to seeing God aright and to making right judgments. And so you better be careful who you partner with. And we see that theme in the New Testament too, don't we? Be careful who you partner with. You know, what business do you have partnering with an unbeliever in certain endeavors? Marriage being the most obvious that's listed there. But be careful who you shack up with or partner up with in this life. Because if they're not for God and their eyes aren't trained on Him, they'll actually blind you in time. So they'll become thorns in your eyes until you perish off this good land. Later in that same that same message, Joshua says one of my favorite things in all that book. He gives the people the credit and the honor of making a personal choice. Even though this is surrounded by warning about if you turn from God. Because he's going to be straight. Look, if you try to do life, if you try to live the good life without God, it's going to be bad. And he is liable to judge you. However, as Joe says so often, and it's starting to train me, we're not puppets. And that's what Joshua says here. You do have a choice. And God will honor that choice. I'm not forcing your hand. Are you going to serve this God or not? And so he says, if it's evil in your eyes, right, which is sometimes why people will reject a given religion, maybe reject Christianity, because they think something is immoral or reprehensible. And so he says, look, if it's evil in your eyes, you go ahead, you find the better thing, you serve the better thing. You go ahead and do that, kind of with a twist of, and see how that works out for you. But God will honor that choice. So if it's evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve. Because you've got options, whether the gods of your fathers, he reminds them, you have pagan roots. Abraham and his family, they were not monotheists. They did not worship this God, at least not worship this God alone. They had household gods. So he says, whether you want to go back to your fathers before I called you out and gave you into the land of Canaan, or the God your father served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. But there's this honoring of choice. When we follow the narrative of Scripture, we're right to emphasize God's choices, God's story, God as the main character. However, we do show up prominently as humans, and we are always given choices. And our eyes are tested. And so this is just a beautiful exhibition of that fact. So we move on into Judges. And the very beginning of Judges, it looks like it might be okay. People are conquering a little bit more of the land, the outlying spots. That's like halfway through Judges 1. By the end of Judges 1, there's already failure to complete the conquest. And so Judges 2, we get the summary statement. And the summary activity that the Lord rebukes is this. This is the summary statement. It's not in relation to a specific act, but all of the acts in Judges that would follow and look like it. And so this becomes idiomatic of all the other failures of vision of the people. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. And so now we start to have this contrast between what the people are seeing and what the people call righteous and what the people do in their own judgments and God's righteous and holy judgments and his viewing their wickedness where it's obvious as being evil in his sight. So we start to get the individual issuance of this statement. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. We get different variations of that throughout in more specifics. So the first one comes in Judges 3:7. And this is prior to the first judge, before Othniel. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Now it's specific. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asheroth. And just quickly, I'll try to come back to this at the end. And I got to start moving really fast now. But the Baals and the Asheroth, among all the other gods that are mentioned in Judges, you know, the God of Sidon and the God of the Amorites, and the overarching ones, the ones that are consistent throughout the land, are these two. The Baals and the Ashtaroth, or the Ashtaroth. And they appear prominently. And what's helpful to know is that, you know, those aren't gods of murder or gods of licentiousness. Those are gods of fertility for the people, but especially for the land, okay? And gods of, like, nature. With Ashtaroth, there's also a combination of being a god of war. And so amidst all of this war, but also trying to produce for your family, that starts to make more sense of why this is such a temptation. You know, this would be the God that would be easy for Malawi to go after. The God that can promise the fertile land and that can control storms. The Baal, I believe, is actually the storm god. And so as a way of trying to control their environment and protect their crops, the people are wont to slip into Baal and Asherah worship. So that's, if you're trying to make sense of how do these people keep doing this, that's part of the reason. There's very practical reasons people serve other gods. So in between this statement that you see on the screen now and the prior one, Othniel is the first judge who comes in to save the day, right? And immediately, these stories end very clearly. The judge dies, and so does the righteousness of the people. And it's so immediate. The judge dies, and the people, it's like they become blind again. And so Judges 3:12, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. That's a double one there, just to lay it on them. Okay? And then after this round of dirty clothes comes Ehud to come do the laundry. So Ehud comes to save the day. After Ehud dies, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. This could get a little discouraging to read this, can't it? just like, what is going to stop this brutal pattern? What can stop this this spiritual schizophrenia? And then you have Shamgar, who's not given much to talk about, but he's fighting the Philistines. And right after that, you have Deborah, who's given a very large narrative. And to me, man, every time I've read it over, I just see so many instances of Deborah, I think intentionally embarrassing and slamming the men. The men who are caving rather than leading. It is a bit embarrassing to read it. And I think it's a needful rebuke. There's definitely a sermon series in there. But when we look at Deborah's great leadership and what she says about the men, and then in her song when she's singing about Jael gets like 3 verses of commendation. But Barak, the army general, just 1 quick sentence. The other guys that show up, 1 quick sentence. The only other men that get a lot of play are the men who fail to show up. Reuben, who experiences great searchings of heart. Where are you, Reuben? Where are you, Asher? Right in her song. But right after this deliverance, what did the people do? In the Lord's sight, the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. It's like, what is going to give here? And then Gideon is called to save Israel. Now here's the first time we see a different use of the word eyes here, not in connection with the people doing evil, but we have Gideon seeing something. And it's the angel of the Lord coming out to meet him. And he's just a nobody. But he's called out, and he's called to be a warrior. And I think this is the most comical of the judge stories. If you keep reading it, you really see Gideon's waffling faith and his kind of wonky spirituality. And I need a sign every other day. And even when I get a sign, then I do things in the cover of night. And then Gideon raising a huge army, and God saying only 300 can go. And so it's quite a funny narrative. But what Gideon sees here is he has a vision of the Lord. He sees the angel of the Lord and says, if I have now found favor in your eyes, which is the most important question, that's the most important issue for the follower of God. Is am I under the favor of the Lord's eyes? How does the Lord look upon me? And seeking his favor, rather than making our personal judgments and doing our level best. So he says, if I found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that it's you who speak with me. And of course, he does give the sign. And that's when we have the next use of the word eye or sight. And the angel of the Lord reached out to the tip of his staff with his hand, touched the meat and the unleavened cakes, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened cakes, and the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. And so there is deliverance. Now, the pattern breaks. And I can't go into this a lot, but I'll probably have to come back to it when we near Samuel and the Kings. But the pattern breaks really, really strongly at the end of the Gideon narrative, and when we get into chapter 9. And the part of the pattern that holds is the evil of Israel. But this new wrinkle in the pattern is of totally debauched and failed leadership entering the picture. And I think it's a bit of a foreshadowing of what happens with the kings and the monarchy later on. Even though God appoints kings, if you keep choosing evil, if you keep pushing me, if you keep resisting the righteous leadership, I'll give you the garbage king you want. That's what you want. You want the vile, speaks gross, acts gross. You want that king? I'll give it to you. And it seems like that's what we get in Abimelech. At the end of chapter 8 of Judges, you do get that same idea. It doesn't use the eyes and the sight, but as soon as, this is verses 33 to 35 of Judges 8, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal-Berith their god. And the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. And they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon. They even forgot their leader in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. And what do you have? You have Israel's first king? That's a weird thing. We're not into the kings yet. But the people want to make Abimelech king. Very interesting. Wish I could get more into it, but we'll get back to that. But the people get what they want there. But of course, it doesn't work out right. It's a total mess. And so the people did evil. They invited this evil ruler to reign, who is not a judge of the Lord. So that's why the cycle is broken. But he's this unrighteous, illegitimate king figure. And the Lord brings his evil upon his own head. And so then you have a few more judges. things seem to quiet down a bit. And then there's further disobedience. And probably the worst description of obedience follows at this end of slideshow. Okay, that's as far as I take you, Barbara. Sorry, but that's all right because I don't have all that much more time, so it's probably for the best. We get to Judges 10:6. And what you'll see here is a connection with the gods the people are going after, being directly connected with the nations that have been left to test the people. And so those nations that are left, who we think, maybe this is, you know, the Lord's mercy, maybe it's good that the people aren't being fully driven out, it's not. And there is tremendous trouble that ensues, and this is the obvious description of it from Judges 10, verse 6 through. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, the gods of the Philistines. They're just piling up gods for themselves, trying to get whatever leverage, whatever security they can. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the Ammonites. They crushed and oppressed the people of Israel that year, and for 18 years they oppressed the people of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in the land of the Ammonites. And after all this is going on, the people recognize their total failure to see things aright. And so they appeal to what the Lord sees. And so you get the next use of that word sight, which shows up in Judges 10:15. The people of Israel said to the Lord, "We have sinned. So do to us." Does this sound familiar? They're like taking the place of the Gibeonites here because they've been so deceitful and so crooked. They have nothing to do but plead for mercy. Do to us whatever seems good to you. And the literal is like, do whatever is good in your eyes. according to your judgments, according to your sight, your perception. Do whatever is good to you in your eyes. And then a very important thing happens for the Lord to bring more deliverance. So they put away the foreign gods from among them and serve the Lord. See, you can't make that genuine plea and expect the Lord's favorable answer. You cannot make that genuine plea and intentionally hold on to your gods, whatever they be. And here's where you have to do the work of applying. Okay, what are those remnant areas of my life? What are the safe places I have given for gods in my life that give me some sense of value or security or pleasure? And if you would appeal to God's favor, he says, you've got to give me those gods too. You've got to put them away. And yes, we need to appeal to God to even aid us in putting them away, because we don't know how to get rid of these gods often enough. But here, the people put away the foreign gods from among them and serve the Lord. And here you see, this is not just history repeating itself, but things are getting worse, because God, who has described himself so many times as long-suffering and slow to anger and patient and merciful to generation upon generation. It's such a sad statement. And he became impatient over the misery of Israel. And maybe sometimes you have sensed the Lord must be impatient over my misery. And whenever we sense that, we are called to serve the Lord with gladness again and to give over those remnant areas that we have saved alive and need to be devoted to destruction. The last use of sight here shows up in Judges 13:1. After this great deliverance again, we'd probably be right to expect that maybe the people would do what's evil in the sight of the Lord again. And in Judges 13:1, we get it. And it's the cause for the final judge, Samson, or at least the final judge in the book of Judges. And the people of Israel, again, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. He gives them over. And there is an analog to this for the New Testament people. Even though we're in a different paradigm, there is an analog that we should recognize. And it's there in the New Testament, even if it's sparing. There are examples where Paul or another church leader says, we're going to give him or her over to Satan, or give them over to testing, or are going to kick them out with the hope that their soul shall be saved. And so it's a temporal, though severe, judgment and a call to bring people back. And so there is an analog for us, and there is a warning that still remains, that if we hold on to the household gods, whatever they are, that we are inviting. We are inviting God's judgment. And we are doing our level best to withhold his blessing. Interestingly, as Samson is the last judge who has this interplay with the eyes and sight, Samson, when he's pursuing his initial wife there of the Philistines, he describes that wife in Judges 14:3 by saying to his mother and his father, his mother and father are questioning his choice of choosing a Philistine woman. And Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she is right in my eyes. So according to my judgment, and then you have the you know, the affirmation of the Lord's plan as part of that in the following verses. But you have, again, this language of in my eyes, according to my judgment. And he repeats that again in Judges 14:7. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. But things get really messy from there. And part of that is a righteous judgment upon the people of Philistines. But certainly a part of the Samson story seems to be his own personal waywardness and I would say self-exaltation and focus on himself and his needs. And he's doing a lot of strange things and meeting out with a lot of strange people and making connections with the wrong women. And so if... I don't know if we're intended to see this, but is it not ironic that at the end of the judges' cycle here, this final judge, his eyes are gouged out. Israel has so devolved in their ability to judge, in their ability to see, that even their judge, his eyes are physically removed. And he pleads for his eyes when he brings his final judgment upon the Philistines. And what you see in that warning about the thorns and the briars being thorns in your eyes, just as the judge, the final judge here, becomes physically blind, the people have become totally spiritually blind. And it's not just, oh yeah, I'm not perfect, nobody's perfect. There's clear admonitions that some people serve the Lord in weakness, in frailty, but they serve the Lord. That whole generation served the Lord. That exists. We have to wrestle with that too. We can't just hide behind the curtain of, oh, look, they did evil again. I'm like that. We did evil again. God says you've got to give up your gods and you've got to get your eyes right and you've got to get your eyes upon me because I am the one who makes right judgments. And so it's a potent warning for us today. It's not just things repeating themselves ad nauseum. And after this series, the blinded judge and the blinded people, if you think I'm kind of reading into that Samson thing, and maybe I am, you at least have to agree that after this point from Judges 17 to 21 is like the most steep drop-off, the most steep character degradation that you can imagine among the people. And the stories that are here would almost feel inappropriate for me to read in church. It's so corrupt, it's so wacky, it's so idolatrous, it's so perverse. And the kind of culminating failure of the site happens when there's this Levite that's been invited to help out one of the tribes in pursuing worship. And there's a mix of a household god in the mix. And the Levite says, you know, when we go on this path that we're going, we're not going to go to these towns because those places are shady. I'll go to this place. But they go to that place, the apparently better place, and what happens? The description is exactly like that of Genesis 14, of Sodom and Gomorrah. Exactly like it. And the people want the Levites. Bring out your Levite so we can have whatever we want of him. And we might wrestle with what the men in the house do. One says, you know, I'll send my virgin daughter. He says, we'll send this guy's concubine, but don't take the Levite. And we might, you know, spend a day thinking about what poor leadership that was. And what utter failure of manliness that was. But the big point is, this is happening in Israel. What the heck is going on? And I think sometimes happens in the church. Like, this is happening in the church. What the heck is going on? That happens in Corinthians when Paul comes and says, why is this guy who is sleeping with his father's wife, why is he just happily sitting in your pews? Where is the rebuke? Where is the righteousness? You got to wake up. And Sodom and Gomorrah, which is like emblematic of all of God's most strong judgments, that scene comes home to roost in Israel. And the rest of the story is not much better. And so while all the enemies were without the remnant, here's the thing that we've got to know. When we leave those enemies, we think, you know, it's just this pocket. It's just lust. It's just rage. It's just greed. We think those are the things on the outskirts, but God's inside, and we'll slowly... Here's the thing. If we're not serious about that, the war goes internal. And the end of Judges ends in a picture of civil war. The people are at each other's necks, and they are disintegrating from the inside out. And so there is a pertinent question for us. It's, you know, what's good in your eyes to do? And whose favor are you seeking? And maybe what gods are there, what corners of life are there that remain a safe place in that land, which is your soul, that is called to be holy. And I would urge you and call upon you, as the Lord is calling me, to purge the evil in our midst and to seek the Lord's sight and be not wise in our own eyes. Because otherwise we can't expect God, because we have Jesus now, God to just grant us rest and blessing and have our cake and eat it too. Just like Judges begins with the cycle of the judges, you have, after the first couple, you have rest for the land. Literally quiet. The land's quiet, which is what land is supposed to do, because land's not supposed to talk. It's just supposed to be quiet land. Ah, quiet land. You ever enjoy just being out? There's no one there. Maybe there's some birds chirping, but just quiet land. That is a beautiful thing. That's the picture that we get occasionally at the beginning of Judges. Quiet land. Even though there's error, there's a chance for redemption and quiet, and the land had rest. But eventually, that pattern breaks when we are unrepentant and resist God's will, and there's no quiet. And we know that feeling of having no quiet in our souls, and there's no rest in this land, and it's just noise, and we are just tired, and we are just weary. And so we are called to be holy, and we are called to get our eyes trained on our God, and yes, on our Savior, who is not like the other judge, he's not like the other judges, our Christ, who brought rest to the people by killing the enemies. But he brings rest to his enemies by letting himself be killed. Whoa. Will we resist that righteous judge who does not kill his enemies to bring peace, but brings peace by letting him being killed by his enemies? Will we resist him? I know you're not, but we have to resist the gods of our land. And there are many. Let us not be fooled. Just because there aren't astropoles, there gods abound. Places we generally seek good things, but in wrong measure and out of order. Maybe we want just a better life. And we need to be reminded of of Jesus' words about guarding our hearts and guarding our eyes. So I'll leave you with that, because I know I'm over time. And you guys have been very patient and long-suffering and slow to anger. Good Christians. So let me close with Matthew 6, 19 to 23. Because Jesus is still warning his church to be pure and be holy, and to purge the evil in our midst, and to lay our eyes on the right things. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, church, there your heart will be also. Well, how do we figure out what our treasure is? The best way, what are you looking at? The eye. This is what immediately follows. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, the whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Let us look to the one who does give light and lightens our eyes. Plead with him to show us mercy when we fail him, as we do, and commit to him to give over whatever household gods or the gods of this world that we are wont to cling to get security or pleasure or to be free from persecution and shame, whatever they be. May we come under his merciful and righteous eyes. Amen.